This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive. This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
A while, so we'll be back next week. And in the meantime, continue to listen, and we've got Where We Live with a very interesting show. It's going to be right here. Stay tuned.
Healthy, desperate Haitians jumping over.
Good evening and welcome to Where We Live for today, Thursday, November 21st, 2010. This evening on Where We Live, we have a report on last Friday's Supreme Court ruling in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And an on-air book party celebrating the upcoming release of The War Before, the true life story of becoming a Black Panther, keeping the faith in prison and fighting for those left behind by Safia Bukhari.
I'm Sally O'Brien.
And I'm Dequi Keone Siddiqui. First, our brother Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Safia, Lioness for Liberation, presente. She had not long passed the half-century mark when her great and powerful heart gave out. 53 years young, with a spirit that was ageless in its love and courage, Sister Safia Asia Bukhari has returned to the ancestors. She was many things to many people: daughter, mother, grandmother, teacher, disciplinarian, soldier, and comrade. Former Black Panther, former combatant in the Black Liberation Army, thinker, truth-teller, activist, and organizer. These were some of the many things she did in her short yet extraordinary life. These things, while undoubtedly significant, do not really begin to tell those who did not know her who she really was. For many, especially many of the nameless and unknown soldiers from various movements still behind bars, she was a lifeline. They knew that she would do whatever was necessary to defend and, if possible, liberate them. They knew that her great, loving black heart would not turn away from them as they dwelled in bondage. She worked tirelessly for black political prisoners, like the New York Three, like Dr. Mutulu Shakur, and others whose names may be little more than distant memories. She was herself a former political prisoner and spent almost a decade in the dungeons of Virginia, and also spent several years on that state's notorious death row. When she couldn't get the medical treatment that she knew she deserved, she escaped to find the life-saving treatment that Virginia denied her. But like her spiritual grandmother, Harriet Tubman, freedom was not hers alone. She worked long and strong for the liberation of her beloved black people. What may surprise many, however, was her original political orientation. She came from a deeply religious and, she would hate the word, conservative family. As a bougie sorority sister, she came to Harlem to study the needs of the black poor while completing her studies. She thought people were poor because they were too lazy to work. What she saw in Harlem, the poverty and hopelessness of the people, as well as the deceit of the cops, radicalized her and led her to the gates of the Harlem Black Panther Party. She, who was once a conservative, became a revolutionary, and she never, ever stopped. It is in that spirit that I share with you the words of Safia Bukhari, learned through the raw experiences of life. Quote, "The hard, painstaking work of changing ourselves into new beings, of loving ourselves and our people and working with them to create a new reality, this is the first revolution, that internal revolution. I'm coming to understand what the old ones meant when they sang the words, 'The race is not given to the swift, nor is it given to the strong, but to him that endures to the end.' And what was meant by the fable of the hare and the tortoise. Some people declare themselves to be revolutionaries, members of one organization or another, i.e., I was one of the first Panthers, or I used to be a Panther, and only come out when there's some major celebration where Panthers are on display and live off their former glory, not understanding that it's not about what you used to be, but what you are doing now. They ran a quick race, utilizing all for the moment, and grew tired and gave up. It may take a little longer to do it the hard way, slow and methodical, building a movement step by step and block by block. But doing it this way is designed to build a strong foundation that will withstand the test of time and the attack of the enemy." Unquote. That's from Safia Bukhari's unpublished manuscript called Reflections, Musings, and Political Opinions. I say to you, many who have known her and many who did not, Safia Bukhari was a true revolutionary, patient, constant, disciplined, loving, and determined. Safia was a revolutionary who, like the Cuban internationalist Che Guevara, was motivated by great feelings of love. It is truly a shame that she left this life so early, but it can be said with certainty that she lived her life with freedom in her rifle scope. She was a woman warrior who should be an inspiration to us all. Remember her by making her dream reality. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And remembering Mumia In a demonstration organized on one day's notice following Tuesday's Supreme Court decision reopening legal avenues to reinstate the death penalty in the case of death row journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal, between 100 and 200 militant supporters converged on 7th Avenue and 125th Street across from the Harlem State Office Building to educate and organize around this internationally recognized case. Our Sally O'Brien was there, and she files this report.
It was a militant crowd that gathered in the cool Wednesday afternoon to show determined support for former Black Panther Mumia Abu-Jamal. A prolific and revolutionary journalist, Abu-Jamal has been on Pennsylvania's death row for 28 years while maintaining his innocence in the shooting death of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. Ori Lumumba of the Free Mumia Coalition and Friends of MOVE told the crowd that for three decades, the courts have played with Abu-Jamal's life. Only the people, said Lumumba, have prevented Mumia's death.
It is us that has kept Mumia alive now for 28 years. It is us when they signed him two death warrants. It's us that got Mumia brought back to phase one to his cell. Don't trust in this goddamn system. But trust in ourselves and our ability and what we can do.
While U.S. courts have refused to hear new evidence in this controversial case or grant Mumia a new trial, supporters and human rights organizations have charged the trial was rife with judicial misconduct. According to appeals transcripts, witnesses were intimidated to change their testimony and evidence was suppressed. Despite widespread calls for a new trial, including international appeals from South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu and French President Jacques Chirac, the Japanese Diet, the United Nations, Amnesty International, and others, in March of last year, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to review his case and affirmed the original conviction. However, last Friday, the Supreme Court did review a petition by Philadelphia's new district attorney to reinstate the death sentence, which was commuted to life in prison by a lower court in 2001. On January 19th, the Supreme Court officially opened legal avenues to reinstate the death penalty by remanding the case back to a federal appeals court, which must now decide whether or not to reimpose the death sentence without a new hearing. Speaking for the December 12th movement, Omawale Clay cautioned that people should not get complacent or fooled into believing that after 28 years, the courts would not kill Mumia Abu-Jamal. He cited another death row case.
When they executed Shaka Sankofa, they led us to believe that he possibly might be free. Then they turned around and executed him. What did we really expect? The state has not changed. They never take their eyes off of us, and they will never take their eyes off of how to destroy our movement. As the Brown Brothers said, Mumia will be alive as long as we're in the streets.
Suzanne Ross, head of the New York Free Mumia Coalition, says what's needed is a federal civil rights investigation. To that end, says Ross, petitions have been delivered to Attorney General Eric Holder asking his Justice Department to examine this case.
They violated the entire process from beginning to end. This is a conspiracy to kill Mumia Abu-Jamal. And it didn't start when he was arrested. It started when he was 15 years old.
Right.
And the FBI began to track him because they knew he was a revolutionary young person
right.
with lots of passion,
That's
that
right.
he was charismatic, that he was brilliant, and that he was committed and principled and was not going to sell out. He's now 55. From the age of 15 to 55, they have monitored his every move. Hoover and his allies and the people he was speaking for decided early, we've got to silence this voice. This leader cannot be allowed to be out there organizing the masses of people.
That's right.
So, this civil rights campaign is an attempt to expose the entire process.
That's right.
It's an attempt to say this whole process has had no justice whatsoever.
At least 20 grassroots organizations attended the rally, pledging to help save Abu-Jamal's life. Larry Holmes, co-director of the Manhattan-based International Action Center, said Mumia represents resistance worldwide to repression.
There are millions of people around the world, supporters and defenders of Mumia, who thought that whatever happens, the death penalty was out of it. That wasn't going to happen. And so they lost interest. But now they know execution was always on the table.
Always.
It was never off the table. And what this ruling makes clear is they want to streamline the brother right into the execution chamber and kill him. So we got to remind people it's wake-up time. Because Mumia is more than one person in a cell. He's the symbol of our resistance to racism, to police brutality, to oppression. He's an international symbol. He's a national reflection of that. And so if they harm him, they harm you. If they harm him, they harm us. When we fight for Mumia, we fight for ourselves. Mumia is all of us.
And while many issues were raised Wednesday evening, the main message demonstrators focused on was stepping up the fight to prevent an execution. But it was the plaintive voice of this 7-year-old that drove the point home.
First of all, we have Mumia in prison, right?
Yeah.
Well, I've been always praying every night to 3 different stars that's always in my windowsill, and all of them are about freeing Mumia. So I've been there, and it took me 2 days. That was not fun. That was not fun. So I've been talking to him since I got there, and he's been pretty good for now. And it looks like it is not good to be in there. I wouldn't want to be in there at all. So we have to free him. We really have to free him. Like, we don't want him to stay in there. I really want him to go home.
The Free Mumia Coalition is holding a strategy meeting on Friday, January 22nd at St. Mary's Church on 126th Street and Old Broadway at 6:30 p.m. For more information, listeners can call 212-330-8029. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Sally O'Brien.
Morning light, silken dream. Take light as the darkness gives way to the dawn. You survived, now your moment has arrived. Now your dream has finally been born. But your faith was as sure as the stars. Now you're free, and the world has come to see just how proud and beautiful you are. Black but all fly, set the sky on fire.
Tonight, Where We Live is honored to present a preview of The War Before, the true life story of becoming a Black Panther, keeping the faith in prison, and fighting for those left behind, by our very own Safia Bukhari. Many in our audience will remember Safia as the co-host for many years on this very program.
Others will remember her as co-founder and co-chair of the Free Mumia Abu Jamal Coalition in New York, and still others as the Minister of Defense and first Vice President of the Republic of New Africa.
And if that isn't enough, many will know Safia Bukhari as an organizer and soldier in the Black Panther Party. In other words, wherever the struggle for liberation and justice is waged, that's where you'd find Safia.
And now, for those who knew and loved her, and for those who never knew her, a wonderful book of her writings gives living voice to her work and legacy. We're joined this evening in the studio by Laura Whitehorn, editor of The War Before, The True Life Story of Becoming a Black Panther. And Safia's daughter, Wanda Jones, is on the phone.
And as well as a fellow Panther sister of Safia's, Pam Hanna, is here in the studio with us. And to all, welcome.
Indeed, welcome.
And let's just begin with you, Laura, because you are the one who edited this book and spent many, many years. And this book is, for people, you're going to hear some of this book tonight. For the listeners, but you will not know the living and breathing work of this book until you actually get it yourself. And the love that you put into this book and the work is plainly apparent. And so talk a little bit about taking this task on.
Well, I have to thank Wanda. Hi, Wanda. Thank you.
Hi, Wanda.
For allowing me to do this, for asking me to help put together Safia's writings. And when you listen to Mumia, you heard him say, he quoted from page 13 of this book, we're just saying. But it was an unpublished manuscript at that point, because when Safia died, she left behind some things that she had written, a whole pile of papers. And Wanda and I put them together, but then they stopped at a certain point, and so we wanted to have more of Safia, because when we started reading it, Safia was such a vibrant personality because she had such passion. She was in love with the people that she was fighting for. She was in love with the concept of freedom, and it came across in every speech she gave. So we wanted to include some of that. And then as we started talking about it, people started giving us old dog-eared, brown, crumply old Panther newspapers. People found for us old tapes of interviews she had given in Chicago. So we put together a lot of it. There was a lot more. But we were convinced by the publisher that after a while, people would not be able to hold the book. So we cut it down. But I think the reason that it's important is because of exactly what Mumia talked about, that a lot of young people who have seen the movies about the Panthers and the TV images of the Panthers see one part of it that was very important, which was self-defense. Then they've also seen the government destroying people and coming in and killing, as they did Fred Hampton and so many other people through COINTELPRO. But what they haven't seen is the daily sweat and the daily love and the daily just creativity and work. And Angela Davis wrote a foreword to this book. And she says, this collection of her speeches and writings reveals Safia Bukhari to be one of the very best examples of dedication to radical change and to revolutionary social justice. Hopefully, it will teach us respect and reverence for the organizer, who so often remains the unknown and unacknowledged figure behind progressive mass movements. And I feel that a lot of times when I talk to younger people and they ask me about the 60s and 70s, they don't get the picture of the hard work. And when I say hard work, it's hard work, but it is joyful work. Mm-hmm. I mean, that organizing that we used to do in groups, and I think that
sanity-provoking
that's something
work.
That we need more of. And Safia speaks to that. the voices of women from those years especially speak to that.
And Wanda, hi, how you doing?
I'm fine.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. And this is for everybody, Wanda Jones. Wanda is Safia's daughter, and she sure didn't fall far from the tree, I'll tell you that, because she's an organizer in her own right and just a wonderful person. And I know that it was difficult for you to launch this project and get it going. And so can you speak about, you know, how you approached it and what impelled you to do it?
Well, yeah, it was difficult for me, but when my mother... this was like her life's work, and when she passed, I found it when I was cleaning out her apartment, and I just knew that it had something had to be done with it, because she would spend her, like, coming from school at night, and she would just spend hours on a computer, just working on it, and I felt like she left it behind for a reason, because she could have been had it published before she passed away. So I felt like this was her saying, listen, I left this for you. I need you to do this for me.
And do you mind, Wanda, if I just read from the beginning of your preface to the book?
No, it's okay.
Okay, because it really will give people an idea of what your thinking was about. And you say, not until my mother passed did I realize how important she was, how hard she worked, how many people admired her and looked up to her. It took me years to understand that although she wasn't around for me when I wanted her to be, the things she was doing instead of raising me made life a little safer for my daughter and other kids. And, you know, I having known you for a good part of your life, you know, I can I can remember many of those struggles. You know, you just struggling with, you know, and in some ways just feeling in competition with the movement. You know, feeling abandoned and so many Panther children and children of activists have suffered the same fate, you know, feeling mixed feelings or just outright dislike, you know, for the movement. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, if the process of this book and other things helped evolve you and heal you from that.
Yeah, it did, and talking to other Panther Cubs that, you know, been in my position, you know, it helped me a lot.
Mm-hmm. And can I just read something, Wanda, that you wrote at the end of this?
Uh-huh.
So Wanda writes, so finally the two parts of my mother, the mother and the activist, are coming together. After she died, I started a foundation to help the families of political prisoners. The Safia Bukhari Albert Noah Washington Foundation provides funds for those families to visit their loved ones. This is my way of carrying on the work my mother began.
And so now I'd like to ask both of you, where did the title come from, The War Before? That's really, you know, that's been a big question mark to me, huh? The
yeah,
War
I
Before.
Know.
That was the, she did that herself. That was the name of her book when she wrote it.
Uh-huh.
So technically, I think that's the only thing that we didn't change was the title to the book.
Yeah, and then when we were putting it together was right after the election.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone was celebrating Obama. And I was thinking, do people know that this wasn't an election? This was the result of years of people dying and struggling and fighting. This was the result of a political movement. And that became the reason why that was such a perfect title at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was a war. I mean, Pam,
absolutely,
you were talking about this when we were waiting, that it was an all-out war. The
it's
police were attacking the Panthers. Yeah.
That right. Pam Hanna? You, of course, were in the party with Safia, you know, maybe not in the same exact branch, but
we
you did a lot of work.
We saw each other. We mingled back and forth. I think everyone went into the Harlem branch that was in the New York Black Panther Party. So you did see, we did see Safia. And even after the split, Safia kept, I mean, to the grind, she kept the office open so that people could understand some of the processes of what was going on. Hi, Wanda.
Hi.
So, reading this book, her voice was just jumping off the page.
Absolutely.
And the feelings,
yes,
that, you know, the personal, I mean, not only was she a comrade, but she was my friend. And to hear her voice, and you can, I can almost see her body language and,
yeah,
reading the words on, and she talked so much about the things that we experience in this war.
Mm-hmm.
One of the, I mean, there's so many things that just touched me personally, and not to mention rewind the memory banks of me. And,
yeah,
and, you know, there's the current and there's the past. And sometimes you think, how long ago was this? Because, it, I mean, you don't, you lose time.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Safia talked about was the post-traumatic syndrome,
mm-hmm,
of warriors.
That's
and
right.
Freedom fighters. And can I read?
Yes, please.
Okay. So she talks about a comrade, friend, loved one of ours, Twyman Myers.
Oh, yes.
Now, Twyman Myers, anybody want to give the story of Twyman? Quick, okay. Twyman Myers was in the Black Panther Party. He was hunted. After the split, he was hunted for various things that they claimed that in retrospect, when I look at the things that they were claimed they were hunting Twyman for, and they led him to the 10 most wanted list, when, you know, the trials and all the smoke settles, it wouldn't have been that serious,
mm-hmm,
you know, in terms of him getting time or being convicted. But they decided to murder him, and they did.
At 23 years
at
old.
At 23 years, mm-hmm, old, in the Bronx, New York. So she says, we had experienced the death and imprisonment of countless of our brothers and sisters who had struggled right beside us, slept in beds with us, eaten at the same table. As I write, there's a picture of Twyman Myers' bullet-riddled body flashes before my eyes, shot so many times that his legs were almost shot off. Now, the other side to the story that she doesn't mention is that after Twyman was murdered by the New York City police, myself, a sister named Eni, and Safia were the ones that had to went and recovered his body and dressed him,
oh,
and prepared him so that he, because he, you know, his mother, so his mother wouldn't see him like that. So when she talked about this, that memory, I tell you, he had so many holes in his body that we were smelling embalming fluid for at least 3 years afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then there's, you know, countless of others. I spoke tonight about Rima Olabala, who was escaping from Brooklyn House of Detention, and me and his significant other was going to pick up his property the next day, and his clothing and books and stuff was thrown on the sidewalk of Atlantic Avenue. Scattered all. So, you know, the stench of indifference.
The stench of hatred.
And hatred.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand why Safia had to write.
Mm-hmm.
She not only had to write to tell the story, but she had to get this out of her. And I think all of us who have had these type of experiences have to find a way, a venue to heal. And I don't think we can, as long as there are so many POWs and political prisons and ongoing things like the atrocities in Haiti at this very moment. But that really jumped at me.
Yeah. Well, shall we let people hear a little bit about who we're speaking about?
Indeed.
Okay. The next voice you will hear is that of Safia Bukhari. She's being interviewed by a young sister named Freddie Smith, who asked her to speak about COINTELPRO.
COINTELPRO is an acronym for the Counterintelligence Program, and I think Ward Churchill describes it best when he talks about it being a program that began not just in the 60s or the 20s, but began when the United States government put together its process of eliminating the natives from the shores, and it was to ensure that the government itself continues. And any kind of dissent, any kind of thing that they thought was a detriment to the government was followed, was detailed, was in surveilled, and a program was put in place to neutralize it, to destroy it, so that the government itself could be ensured. in the 60s, COINTELPRO worked against the Black Panther Party and other black nationalists or black liberation organizations by putting out false information, by surveillance, by putting agents and informers within the midst, by paying informers to be there, by sending out false letters about and putting out false rumors about people, and by just misinformation and disinformation being put out into the communities about what these people were about, what the organizations were about, and anything to destroy the credibility of the organization and criminalize the political work of the organization. And it manifests itself in the Black Panther Party and with other black nationalist organizations by destroying the credibility, by keeping up animosity, by keeping people within the organizations who were really young, naive in a lot of sense, fighting among each other and distrusting each other. And inevitably, it led to the destruction of the Black Panther Party. But I just want to also say that the COINTELPRO looked at the weaknesses within people and the weaknesses within the organization and preyed on those weaknesses and heightened those contradictions that were manifested were there in the first place. If the contradictions and if the weaknesses were not there, then COINTELPRO, its job would have been harder to do.
How did the East-West divisions manifest themselves under COINTELPRO? What were the methods and the devices used to create the split?
Well,
and who?
One of the things, I don't like it to be seen, is the, when people say East-West, that in itself is not an accurate analysis of what went down with the split in the Black Panther Party, because there were people from the West Coast, people from the East Coast that aligned themselves with various sides. So it wasn't an East-West, it was an ideological split that was heightened by the internal contradictions within the organization itself. What people, one of the things that we had been taught in going into the Black Panther Party is no investigation, no right to speak. And so if someone told you something, you should have, by principle, investigated and go to the source and get the truth before you make a move. What COINTELPRO did was, because people didn't internalize the principles that they were taught, COINTELPRO was able to spread misinformation, send false letters to various leaders, people within the ranks of the Black Panther Party, on the leadership end. When people talk about the split, they see the split as happening in the hierarchy with Eldridge Cleaver and Huey Newton, but it was further than that. On our level where we were at the time of the split that went down, it was much deeper than that. The problems were in the very structural deviation from the principles of democratic centralism, deviation from the principles that this was a people's organization, and people started getting into materialism, into drugs, into a whole bunch of other stuff that was contrary to what the party was about. And COINTELPRO was able to fan those flames of discontent. And on the leadership level, the egos were there, and it was able to send messages to Huey that Eldridge was talking about him, and he was planning to do him, and sending messages to Eldridge that this was happening, and it was able to plan that kind of thing. But between the party and the US organization, it was able to continue to utilize those kind of misinformation and false letters and lies to keep the division there going, that even led to the murders of Bunchy and John. Within the party, the fratricide also continued with the split because of the Huey Newton, Eldridge Cleaver factionalism, and that was heightened by the state and the COINTELPRO, you led to Robert Webb and Sam Napier being killed. So that's the kind of thing that inevitably led to the destruction of the Black Panther Party. And it was a COINTELPRO operation because the letterhead memorandums that were sent out by that time gave those agents within the center, FBI and others, the authority to use whatever means they can, including to send out these letters, including going into organizations and sleeping with people and then telling the people that they were doing this and brutalizing people, planting evidence on people and that leading to their arrest, giving up people who were underground, the whole structure that led to a lot of the dissent within the Black Panther Party.
As part of COINTELPRO and under the mass arrests and the kind of clamp down and the actual thoroughness trying to stifle the different members there, you know, there were different tactics.
Well, maybe we should go back to what led to the capture and my confinement.
Okay.
And what initially happened is that in the New York 3 were on trial and in New York, and at that point it was the New York 5, and that was Herman Bell, Anthony Bottoms, Albert Washington, and the Torres brothers, and they had been charged with the assassination of two New York City police officers and conspiracy, and that whole thing that they had been doing following from 1971 on, especially in New York around BLA members. And I had been part of a defense effort around them, along with a lot of other sisters, and what basically the defense of political prisoners had more or less saw to a lot of the women in the movement, especially women in the Black Panther Party, with the many political prisoners we had. And I was still working out of the Harlem office, and Yuriko Shaman, myself, and a whole bunch of others, like the 12 of us, were subpoenaed and came with it immunity.
Right.
And so we had to make some choices of whether or not we were going to go before the grand jury and face felony contempt for not answering all the questions. And it was finally determined I was not going to even go into the grand jury room at that time because I could not, there was no way I was going to give information on the Black Panther Party or the Black Liberation Army or anything that might have been detrimental to the movement. So I didn't go. So, and I went underground rather than to testify. And when I got arrested in Virginia, the FBI was supposed to have been a state case, but the FBI was the one who had the press conference saying that I was dangerous and known to law enforcement agencies all over the country. And what constituted the dangerousness was the fact that I had not had any prior felonies or anything else, and that I was politically conscious. And I think that
you
was
were dangerous
major,
to them.
I
That's
was
what
dangerous
was.
To them because of that. Anyway, I was captured in Virginia. I was charged with attempted murder, armed robbery, and attempted and possession of a machine gun and the whole thing. And my bail was set at $1 million on each count, and I was facing the electric chair for the first 30 days. Well, anyway, I ended up getting 40 years and getting sent to Virginia Correctional Center for Women in Goochland. But I wasn't there more than 2 months when the FBI came to visit, and they said that I could make parole that day if I would give them the information they wanted. And, I mean, according to the law, my eligibility date for parole was 10 years down the road. But they was there. They offered me parole immediately and $75,000. And I refused. And every year from that point on, they were doing the same thing, coming back. But the whole thing was that the reason why I was in prison was because they wanted information. They couldn't get the information. And so they were using that as a pressure base. But in the course of that time, I was kept in maximum security segregation. I had to undergo a complete hysterectomy. I was in maximum security for 3 years and 7 months. It was a whole, every step of the way on everything that happened to me, I had to go through courts in order to do it. And that totally had nothing to do with the alleged crime I was convicted of, because people were there doing life sentences and everything else and not having the same kind of treatment that I was undergoing.
Is it that the U.S. is too powerful? Is it that, you know, they have eyes everywhere? Is it possible to have a Black liberation struggle that can succeed, given our new knowledge, given our what we know they are capable of doing?
I think it's possible. I think it's possible because if we, in fact, learn from all the mistakes of the past, and that means that it can't be an I thing, it can't be an ego-based thing, it can't be doing it for the purpose of reckoning. It has to be where people are willing to sublimate the individual odds for the good of the whole. And I think that some of us have learned that lesson, that we have to be in this together, and it has to be about something more than ego gratification. And the other thing is that I think a lot of us have learned that trust is the base of a lot of this, and that we can't just talk the rhetoric of principles, that we have to internalize it. And I think there's a lot of us out here who have survived the 60s, who may have been not doing anything for the last, and you know, out there for the last 10 or 15 years, but who have been healing themselves and structurally building things in small groups over and over all the place, who prepare to try to put that into place and do it, and do what has to be done. And I think that we cannot just look at the brashness of the youth and think that they're the ones who have to deal with it. I think that we have to recognize that it has to, the maturity of the elders who have learned that has to be a part of that process also. So it just can't be youthful and exuberance can't be the whole, and the wisdom of the ages can't just be the whole. That we have to find a way to put that all together with the experience and the knowledge and the things that we've learned over the last 20 years. And I think if we can do that, it can work. Also, the other big crush that we have to deal with is the question of sexism, and recognizing that we cannot allow those kind of schisms and isms to separate us and hit and stagnate the job that we have to do. Right now, as you know, I'm in Chicago as the co-chair of the Free Mumia Abu-Jamal Coalition and trying to do some organizing out here and putting the things together around the Million Letter Campaign to Janet Reno that we're supposed to deliver on May 20th in Washington, D.C. at the Department of Justice. And then also I'm out here because this weekend in Chicago is Black Nation Day, and I'm trying to set some things up for that. Also, I'm continuing to work around the issue of political prisoners in general, and specifically the Black Panthers who are still in prison all these years, and members of the Black Liberation Army that still languish in prison. And at the same time, trying to put some cohesiveness around this whole work around pulling our movement back together. And so that's what I'm doing, and I think that's what I'm going to be doing for a while.
The voice of Safia Bukhari speaking on WBAI, as a matter of fact, in the spring of 1996.
Unless we share with each other, we gotta start making changes. Learn to see me as a brother instead of two distant strangers. And that's how it's supposed to be. How can the devil take a brother if he's close to me? I let it go back to when we played as kids, but then it changed. That's the way it is. Come on, come on.
That's just the way it is. Things will never be the same. That's just the way it is. Oh yeah, that's just the way it is. Things will never be the same.
And Safia writes, if we truly are to create a new society, we must build a strong foundation. If we truly are to have a new society, we must develop a mechanism to struggle from one generation to the next. If we truly are to maintain our new society after we have won the battle and claimed the victory, we must instill into the hearts and minds of our children, our people, ourselves, the ability to struggle on all fronts, internally and externally, laying a foundation built upon a love for ourselves and a knowledge of the sacrifices that went before and all we have endured. There is much to be done to achieve this. There is a long road ahead of us. Let's do it.
But that's the way it is. Come on. Come on.
That's just the way it is. Things will never be the same.
And the prophetic words of Tupac Shakur underneath. And this is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. The program is Where We Live. I'm Sally O'Brien.
And I'm Dequi Keone Siddiqui.
And we're here in the studio with Pam Hanna, Laura Whitehorn, and on the phone, Wanda Jones. And let's just get back to the book for a minute. You know, The War Before, the true life story of becoming a Black Panther, keeping the faith in prison, and fighting for those left behind by Safia Bukhari, has a foreword by Angela Davis, a preface by Wanda Jones, an introduction by Laura, who's sitting right here, and an afterword by Mumia Abu-Jamal. And in between are one pearl of wisdom, one organizing thought, the theory of Safia Bukhari into action. You know, you cannot ever separate that there was no empiricism, you know, in Safia. Safia was just a capacious human being, you know. She acted, she thought, she did everything. I mean, Safia at 2 o'clock in the morning would be making mouse pads. She'd call you, I know what we can do for the political prisoners. Mm-hmm. You know, I know what we can do. We can make mouse pads with their faces on it, and that's how we can organize. And then another time, we can make greeting cards, you know. Mm-hmm. Everything was about the work. And
you can see that. I'm sorry, Sally.
No,
you
no,
can
go ahead.
In the interview, there was about 7 or 8 things she listed that she was doing in Chicago.
Yes.
For the weekend.
Yeah, in fact, the way we found some of these chapters, I listened to another interview that she had done on a radio station in Chicago when she was there for an Attica conference, remembering the Attica Rebellion. And at the end of it, she's asked, what are you doing now? And she said, oh, I'm writing a book about post-traumatic stress and syndrome in the Black Panther Party. And I said, she was doing what? And we set about, and Ashanti Austin dug out for me an old Panther paper where that chapter is. Mm-hmm. And woven through the whole book is not just that kind of the observations she makes in that interview about COINTELPRO, about how people forgot their principles, but she also delves into her own psyche and her own personality, and she's very open about her own errors. And that is what we have to do, to look at the past. You can't just say, oh, this is what that person did. Safia had the courage to say, this is what I did. And from that also, you can follow through this, the strategy of how to build support for political prisoners. Mm-hmm. Because that is something that Safia was committed to
her life
from
work
the whole time. And I think that for those of us who still are committed to that work, it's very important to analyze some of what she talks about in her questions and answers about how Jericho was begun, and then did it stay that same organization, and how should we build it now? And I just want to say that in the next few weeks there are going to be some book parties, and one of them that I want to talk about specifically is on Wednesday, February 3rd, at Medgar Evers College, 1650 Bedford Avenue in Brooklyn. Safia Bandelli and the Center for Women's Empowerment is hosting a party to celebrate the book, and Wanda will be there. And Pam Africa has been invited and is going to come. Not only was she a very close friend and comrade of Safia's, but she also is going to talk more about Mumia and the situation with Mumia, because can anyone imagine celebrating a book of Safia Bukhari and not at this moment in history to organizing people to support Mumia Abu-Jamal. And also at those, there are a list of events which people can find if they go to the website for the book, which is feministpress.org. That's the publisher. Feministpress.org. That's where you can get the book, and that's where you can see all the different events. We are going to be reading messages that we've already gotten from some of the political prisoners about the book, including from Jaleel Muntakim and Herman Bell, two of the New York Three. And one of the things in the book is
a listing
of all the political prisoners. But there's also, we transcribed a program that was done about the New York Three, and it was called CBS Tries the New York Three. And for anyone who's trying to understand now the role of the mass media in criminalizing the people of Haiti, in criminalizing the people who are in prison and brainwashing, I mean, I don't know what else to call it, the people of this country, if you read CBS Tries the New York Three, they break it down. A lawyer and Safia and Jaleel and Herman and Noah Washington, who died in prison, talk about how the mass media dealt with that case and with other political prisoners in order to scare the public and make people not support them.
And that's still happening. And when you talked about Safia saying that she was writing a book about post-traumatic stress syndrome, Wanda, I'm sure, can talk about this as well. Safia was planning to get her degree. In fact, she did get her degree in psychology. Isn't that true, Wanda?
Yeah, she graduated in, I don't know what year. I forgot what year she graduated, but I was in living in Albany at that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And she said to me, she said, I'm graduating, you have to be there. I said, Mom, I got to go to work. I said, that time I was working like 11 at night to like 7 in the morning. And she said, well, I need you to be here. I got off of work and I drove all the way to New York to be at my mom's graduation. Mm-hmm. And when I seen her get her diploma and they get different, they wear different colors at York College of what they're getting their degree in. And when I seen it, I was like, she had on two different colors. I said, oh, my God, she got two degrees. I thought she was only going for one. So I was like, okay, you go ahead, lady.
She could never do just one thing at once.
Yeah. I said, you in your 40s and you trying to do all this, trying to make up for lost time. So she was like, no, she just wanted to make sure that she had all this stuff that, you know, she was showing me an example that don't matter what age you are, you can always graduate from college.
She had a new meaning to multitask.
Oh, yeah, boy, that's
true. Before we even started saying that word, right?
But the reason why she went back to school to get this degree was because, as she put it, she was going to put out a shingle and be that person that her comrades could come to talk about post-traumatic stress syndrome and heal themselves. So, I mean, it was just another facet of the work to her.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the most incredible thing. Safia could put more work into 1 minute than most of us put into a whole day, you know.
A whole year.
So we are wrapping up. You know, the Haiti show is going to come on in a few minutes, and we do have to vacate the studio very, very shortly. So I'd like to just complete this by saying that if you've never met Safia Bukhari before, or if you have met her and miss her, as we all do, because Safia left us in 2003, and yet there is a living legacy in all of us. You know, we carry her with us, and that's the only thing that you could do. You know, you just pick it up and keep on going. And so I urge everybody to get this book, The War Before, and also to go to feministpress.org. And Safia would kick me, you know, she'd reach through the ethers and just kick me if I didn't tell you that there is an organizing meeting, a strategy session at St. Mary's Church tomorrow night, Friday night at 126 Street between Old Broadway and Amsterdam at 6:30 p.m. to strategize around the case of Mumia, who is very, very close to the stroke of a pen reinstating a death penalty. So let me just say 3308029 is the number of the Mumia Coalition, and that in honor of Safia and also our beautiful brother Mumia, who is here with us, and we need to keep him here.
And I should just say that, Wanda, you can back me up on this. The person who did the most work on this with me and Wanda was Mumia.
Yeah,
we wrote to him, right?
From the beginning, when I first asked him to write, you know, he was like, he was honored, and I was like, well, you know, if you need anything, let us. He's like, no, I'm honored. She sacrificed a lot for me, and I was like, and he's like, and when you need somebody to talk to, or you just want to, you know, just reach out, just write me, and I'll write back, or I'll make sure that I could get a word into you. And I was like, all right, that's, you know, that's love right there. I felt that, you know, no matter what, it's love. Because most people, you know, they don't put other people's children ahead of them. And I thank God that I have Panther moms and Panther fathers that have been my cornerstone and have been my rock through all of this. Because I'm telling you, even like now, I don't know what I would do. It's been days and times that I miss my moms to the fullest. And I just, like, thank God that I have all these different people and different parts of them in my life that knew my moms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know what I would do some days without them.
And I love you too, Wanda.
Well, I think that that's a good note to end on. I would like to just, Pam Hanna, you being a sister in the party, I'd like to give you a 30-second last word.
30-second last word. Well, had Safia had an opportunity, well, the last thing that she wrote about was the case of Kamal Siddiqui. But had she been still alive, she would have written about the San Francisco Eight, and she would have been writing about everything that has come today. She'd be talking about Haiti.
Yes, she would.
So on that note, I think the Haiti program is coming on.
That's right. That's right. Laura Whitehorn, Wanda, Pam, thank you for coming on. And it wasn't long enough. This show went too fast because Sister Dequi also had a big role with Safia, and that's part two. So this has been Where We Live for today, the 21st of January, 2010. I'm Sally O'Brien.
And I'm Dequi Keone Siddiqui.
Thank you for listening.
And thank you for caring.
No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. World has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, oh, oh. Wake up all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say.
They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. But just let it be. Na, 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.